And start.
Okay. Okay. Today is Chaf Sivan, and I want to, as I was looking into Chaf Sivan, I'm always actually intrigued about Chaf Sivan. My interest in Chaf Sivan began when I, with the debate that took place as to whether there should be a special day where we focus on the Holocaust as a memorial for those that were killed in the Holocaust. And the analogy that was always drawn was with Chaf Sivan. Of course, the catastrophe of the Holocaust was much greater than the catastrophe of Chaf Sivan. And as a result of that, I became very interested in the discussion that surrounded Chaf Sivan, and to a certain degree, I became interested why the efforts to make Chaf Sivan a day of fasting were not successful. Now, Chaf Sivan was proclaimed as a fast day by Rabbeinu Tam, one of the cities, I think, in France. There was a non-Jewish anti-Semite who happened to kill a non-Jewish child. It's not clear that he killed the non-Jewish child as an act that was part of his original plan to make charges that the Jews did that murder. It could be it was done for other reasons, but he became aware that there was a Jew that saw him murder the child. And as a result, he spread the rumor that the Jews killed the child, and this was the beginning of the blood libels that took place throughout Europe. But this was the first one. And at that time, Rabbeinu Tam proclaimed the fast day for all generations. In fact, it's brought down that Rabbeinu Tam said that he feels that this fast day will become more important than, I don't know if he meant halachically more important or perceived as being more important than even some Gedalia. And now the question was raised. Now, Rabbeinu Tam, we always talk about two crusades. There were actually three crusades. And what we call the second crusade was really the third crusade. In Rabbeinu Tam's time, there was the second crusade. A number of Jews were killed, but a small number of Jews were killed. It wasn't like the first crusade, and certainly not like the second crusade, where so many thousands upon thousands of Jews were murdered. But the question is, the first crusade, which took place in the time of Rashi, the grandfather of Rabbeinu Tam, no fast day was proclaimed. So that was shortly before Rabbeinu Tam's time. So the question is, why did Rabbeinu Tam feel that he should go against the precedent and proclaim a fast day because as a result of this blood libel, many Jews in that town were killed, And many of them were Goli Yisrael. We don't know of them as Rishonim today because they were killed and we don't have their works. But the way it's written about them, these were outstanding people who, had they not been killed, would have become part, their works would have been part of our library, so to say, of Svarim. And they were burnt alive on Chaf Sivan. And it's brought down that while the flames did kill them, the flames did not do much to their bodies. And as the fire was burning, it's brought down that they were singing Aleinu L'Shabeach. And there were groups, and it's well known, just as a side point, that the yeshiva of Kelem, which was one of the outstanding Musar yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael, when they were being killed by the Nazis, they also sang Aleinu L'Shabeach. I'm mentioning this because all of a sudden there is a new Frumkeit. In order to identify with, or disidentify is a better word, disidentify with the shul practices in America, for some reason, people who have their attitudes in a strange sense of priority, think that it's important not to sing Aleinu L'Shabeach. Now, to be honest, I don't sing Aleinu L'Shabeach, but I never sang Aleinu L'Shabeach. When I was in elementary school, I did sing it, but my shul doesn't sing it, so I don't sing it, and I'm not going to tell them to sing it. But to consider it some kind of status not to sing it shows a lack of knowledge. And it's a lack of knowledge how Aleinu L'Shabeach was sung by the Jewish people being murdered for being Jewish. I guess that some people consider being yeshivish more important than trying to disassociate from the custom of that many of the Goshen practice when they were being executed for being Jewish. Now in the Kinnis, it's mentioned by Rabbeinu Kalonymus that there was an attempt to make a day of, to make a day of fast, a day of slichos, on the during the period of time which would commemorate the murder of the Jewish people during the First Crusade. But it was decided not to do it because they felt the more appropriate time to do that would be on Tisha B'Av. After all, Tisha B'Av commemorates not just the burning of the Beis HaMikdash, but it commemorates the whole Golus. It commemorates not having the Beis HaMikdash. It commemorates the fact that the Jewish people went into exile. It commemorates all the tragedies that took place during that exile. And consequently, the decision was made not to have a special day to commemorate the murder of the Jewish people during the Crusades. And so there seems to be a contradiction. On one hand, Rabbeinu Tam proclaimed for all Ashkenazic Jewry, probably proclaimed it for everybody, but Rabbeinu Tam and the Rashbam, they were considered the leaders of the Ashkenazic Jewry. And their authority extended over the Ashkenazic community. So on one hand, they proclaimed the fast day for generations on Chof Sivan. On the other hand, there was no fast day for an incident that happened a few years prior, which was certainly a greater tragedy in terms of the magnitude of the events that took place than the incident, as tragic as it was, and it was very tragic, during the lifetime of Rabbeinu Tam. So my uncle, I read, said that he felt that there was a dispute between Rabbeinu Tam and Rabbeinu Kolonimus. Rabbeinu Tam's opinion was that there should be a fast day for some of the events that took place during the Golus, in addition to the observance of Tisha B'Av. Whereas Rabbeinu Kolonimus' opinion was that the appropriate day to commemorate any tragedy that took place during the Golus is Tisha B'Av. And consequently, no other day should be proclaimed as a fast day or as a day of mourning for these events. And my uncle said he really, according to the notes that I read, he really doesn't understand why Rabbeinu Tam felt that was important to have a separate day when no separate day was proclaimed for because of those that were killed during the Crusades. But I think that we could suggest that there was a difference. And it's not that Rabbeinu Tam rejected Rabbeinu Kolonimus' opinion. There is no doubt that every tragedy that takes place during the Golos is part of the Churban. It's part of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash and of the Jewish people being sent into exile. But we have to view things not just from the perspective, the objective perspective, Rabbeinu Tam felt. Rabbeinu Tam felt that it was necessary. In other words, there was a purpose in these fast days. The purpose of these fast days was to make an impression about the loss, about the tragedy, and perhaps the insecurity that the Jewish people had throughout Golos, throughout the exile. And his feelings probably was that because it was an incident that happened in one town and in one city, people will not identify it with the Churban. Rabbeinu Tam understood that what happens in one city on one day can and will happen in other cities on other days. Blood libels continued throughout the history of the Jewish people, up to and including the 20th century. Yes, Each time it was in one different place. But Rabbeinu Tam, Chacham Adif Menavi, there are great people that see the impact that isolated incidents can have. When there is one act of anti-Semitism, it breeds other acts of anti-Semitism. But Rabbeinu Tam felt that people will not identify that with the Churban. So he felt that it was necessary to proclaim a separate day for this tragedy. Otherwise, this tragedy would be ignored. And it was important for Jewish people to realize their insecurity, their dependency on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and to mourn the loss of the Gdolei Yisrael that lived in this one town, in this one city. Now, and the truth is that the takana of Rabbeinu Tam, in spite of Rabbeinu Tam's prediction that it will become more accepted than Tzom Gedalia, nevertheless, this past day was never really accepted. And my uncle, from the notes of the shiurim that I read, seemed to imply that the shita of Rabbeinu Tam was not accepted by Klal Yisrael. I think that perhaps we could suggest that for the same reason it was really not accepted by Klal Yisrael. It was not accepted because, unfortunately, we have this tendency that when a tragedy happens in one city and in one place, we consider it an isolated incident. And because of this, they felt that really it didn't affect them. And of course, history proved them incorrect. Now, even though Chav Sivan that was proclaimed Rabbeinu Tam was never really accepted as a fast day, later on, in the times of Tachtatat Chomensky, when Chomensky killed 500,000 Jews in a period of about, this is what some say, in a period of about 6 months. And at that time, the Gdolei Yisrael and the Ashkenazi countries again proclaimed Chav Sivan, because Chav Sivan was a time again when some of the outstanding Torah scholars of the time were killed. As that's the fast day was for everybody. They just have to pick that day. So they proclaimed the fast day for generations. Tosfos Yontif was involved. The Shach was involved. The Magen Avraham mentions it. I think the Taz was involved. Probably it's the Rabboni Arba Aratzos was involved. And although it never became universally accepted, I've read that till the Holocaust, there were numbers of Jews in different places that did observe Chav Sivan. Matter of fact, in some Siddurim, there are even Slichas. If you have an old Siddur, some Siddurim have Slichas for Chav Sivan. But today, it's almost not observed at all. Probably not observed. Now, but what I found, what I was intrigued about is that when I read about the takana that was made, so some say they proclaimed it a fast day, but they said they didn't proclaim it a fast day for everybody, for every male who was 13 and a female who was 12. They proclaimed it as a fast day for males. I saw some places 17 years old, and some places I saw 18 years old. And for women, they proclaimed it a fast day for those, of course, and anything above that age, as a fast day for those that were 15 years old and 16 years old, depending on which source one looks. And the question is, it seemed to be very strange. Why didn't they, once they were proclaiming it as a fast day, why didn't they proclaim it as a fast day for anybody who reached the age of godless? Anyone, a male of 13 and a female of 12. But even if you say they considered them young, too weak at that time, so then the question is, why differentiate between male and female? Make it 15, make it 18, make it 20, whatever it is, but for everybody. So it dawned on me that, well, we know, we say, Ben Yudches L'Chuppah, that the Mishnah says that a person should get married at the age of 18. The Rambam says 18 means the 18th year when one is 17 years old. But it's not so much. So in other words, the chiyuv of getting married, according to the Rambam, begins when one is 17 or 18 years old. And he's considered to be mevatel the mitzvah, depending on the circumstances, by the age of 20. Obviously, I don't think that these today we could encourage everybody to get married at this early of an age, but these were the ages that were identified with marriage. As a matter of fact, I had someone check. And he told me that in Europe at that time, males got married. Of course, there are many cases of people who got married earlier, and there were cases of people who got married later. But the average age was about 17 for a male, and a female was 15 or 16. Now, so whatever it is, my assumption is that the reason they proclaimed the fast is because they felt there was some connection between marriage and the need to fast. And perhaps because of the gzeiros of Tach v'Tat, because of what happened at the time of Chomansky. And I want to now go to the Sedra, and perhaps on basis of some of the ideas that we could deduce from the Sedra, we would be able to understand why the Chachamim of that time, at the time of the Shach, and at the time of the Tosfos Yontif, proclaimed the fast day that had some association, that seems to have some association with marriage. Now, the Torah tells us in Parsha Shelach that the spies, when they were appointed by Moshe, the leaders of the tribes, Kulam Nashim, Rashi B'nai Yisrael Hema. So at that point, when they were appointed as spies, they were Anashim Tzadikim. They were righteous people. But then the Medrash tells us Torah tells us they came back and they led a rebellion against Moshe, against HaKadosh Baruch Hu, against God. How are we to understand it? That Anashim Tzadikim, Rashi B'nai Yisrael Hema, leaders of the Jewish people, should all of a sudden change their attitude. And I've discussed this question before, and I've said you have people that are situational tzaddikim. In a given situation, so long as they were by Moshe Rabbeinu, they were devoted to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, devoted to the Torah, devoted to Klal Yisrael, devoted to the Mesorah. But once they left Moshe Rabbeinu, they encountered an altogether different situation. And not only that, it's interesting, the Medrash says, it wasn't just at the end of the 40 days, but it was at the moment they left that they began to plot against Moshe Rabbeinu. So how could it happen? Overnight, in one moment, they go from being Rashi B'nai Yisrael Hema to being enemies of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and leading a rebellion against Moshe. And I think, now we see that the same thing, I mentioned it, by the Jewish people, they said Nasa v'Nishma at Har Sinai. And then Moshe Rabbeinu disappears, okay, for 40 days. And he returns, and there's an Egel Hazav there. And when they said Nasa v'Nishma, they were on the level of Malachim. What's the answer? The answer is, it was situational commitment. And even though they might have said, no, regardless of the situation, even though there's some that say that's why it was Kafa Aleihem Har Gigigis, nevertheless, people who it's not ingrained in them, the importance of commitment, regardless of the situation, as great as their commitment can be within a given situation, it does not prove anything what's going to happen when the situation changes. And I think, it's very interesting, but that explains the 10 Meragim. But there were two spies who overcame this influence of the who overcame the influence this influence one who overcame the influence was Yehoshua, and the other was Kalev. How did Yehoshua overcome the influence? Yehoshua overcame the influence because Moshe Rabbeinu changed his name from Hosea to Yehoshua. He added a Yud, and he said, Kah, Yud stands for God's name. Kah Yoshiacha Me'atzas Meraglim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu should save you from the plan of the Meraglim. What was the idea? And Kalev, how did Kalev overcome the influence? Kalev overcame the influence because Kalev overcame the influence because when he came to Hebron, he went to the Maras Machpelah and he davened at the Maras Machpelah and he besieged HaKadosh Baruch Hu and asked the Yavos to besiege HaKadosh Baruch Hu on his behalf, that he should overcome that influence. Now, why is it that two different approaches are used? I don't think that's a real question. Because we say each person is different. You can't use one approach for two people. My father would always say, "Vayivra lekimas adam b'tzalmo," God created man in his image. And the image of God he was created is redundant. But the answer is that God created man, my father said, in his image, in man's own particular image. Each man has their own separate mission in life. Each person is different. So Yehoshua had one background. Yehoshua was the Talmud of Moshe. And he faced a challenge now. His main challenge was that he was going to leave Moshe. It was a different situation. Kalev, on the other hand, Kalev was not so close to Moshe. We could assume that Kalev saw himself, in a sense, he focused on his relationship with the Avos, with Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And for some reason, leaving the camp of Klal Yisrael presented a challenge to him, even from that perspective. I just have to, for 1 minute, I have an emergency call. I'll have to interrupt for 1 minute. I'll be back in a minute. So, now, in order to understand Yehoshua's challenge and how Yehoshua dealt with it, how Yehoshua was able to deal with that challenge because of the name change, I want to discuss something that I've discussed many times before. There are three svarim that I'll discuss it very quickly. There are three svarim, three books that were written by Shlomo HaMelech: Keheles, Mishlei, and Shir Shirim. In Keheles, so Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, identifies himself as Keheles, the son of David. In Mishlei, he identifies himself as Mishlei, the son of David. In Shir HaShirim, he says, Shir HaShirim HaShir L'Shlomo. He says, these are the song of songs of Shlomo. He doesn't say the son of David. And the question, Rashi raises the question, why doesn't he say he's the son of David in Shir HaShirim, like he says in his other svarim? And I've mentioned many times that what I thought was the answer was that Keheles is primarily based on the idea of fear of God. Sof davar hakol nishma, the total sum of everything, Keheles says, es elikim yirei ves mitzvosim shemor, the sum total of everything is fear of God. So the fear of God is something, fear is something that's given over from father to son, from teacher to student. So the matter of fact, Yaakov refers to God as Pachad of the Yitzchak, the fear of my father Isaac. So he identified fear of God with his father Yitzchak. It's something that's given over. So therefore, it's Kehelis ben David, Kehelis the son of David. Mishle, Rashi says, Mishle is divrei tochacha, divrei musar. It's chastising, ethics. Pirkei Avos is called the ethics of the fathers. And we say, Shema b'ni musar avicha. So it's something that's given over from father to son. Shir Hashirim is love of God. Love is a personal relationship. Love can't be given over. Love is just personal. It's Shlomo and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Solomon and God. David doesn't play a role over there. That's the end. It's interesting. And this is because we have a double relationship. Yaakov Avinu, when he was forced to leave his father's house, and he had the dream of Sulam Mutzavatz of Hiroshima Magia Shemaima, he had the dream of the ladder that reached heaven. And God told him that God told him he'll watch over him. So he said, Im yelakim amadi, if God will be with me, Ushmarani Bader Chazar Sharnochi Holeich, and he'll watch me on this road that I'm going, Vinasan Milechem Lechos, me bread to eat, or begged Lubosh and clothes to wear, Vishafti Bishalom Beisavi, and I'll return in peace to my father's house. Bahayashem Lilakim, God will be a God for me. So everybody asked the question. Yaakov Avinu is making a deal with God. Yaakov, the Bechir Avos, the chosen one of the patriarchs, is God. You'll be good to me. I'll be good to you. Otherwise, forget it. How can we suggest such a thing? But the answer is, Yaakov was certainly devoted and would have continued being devoted to God. But he said, so long as I was in my father's tent, in the tent of Yitzchak, so my primary relationship with God was through my father Yitzchak. But now that I am forced to leave my father's house, I will try to focus, to build up, to strengthen my personal relationship with God. V'haya Hashem li le'lokim, God will be my God. And I won't need special miracles for it. The things that people take for granted in a love relationship, what's the focus? The focus shouldn't be the special trips, the special things, the things that are normally taken for granted, the lechem lechol, the beged lilbosh, the shafti b'shalom obeis, the returning in peace to the house, the things that people take for granted, I can establish my personal relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So, Bahaya Hashem li le'lokim, God will be a God for me. And it's interesting, when you take a look at Rashi and Shir HaShirim, he of course asked the same question. Why is it that Kehelis and Mishle, Shlomo is identified as Ben David, as the son of David, but in Shir HaShirim, Shir HaShirim, Shir LeShlomo? So he says you have to understand Shir HaShirim on a certain level. Shir HaShirim Asher L'Shal Shlomo. Shlomo means HaMelech Shahashalim Shalo. So Shir HaShirim Asher L'Shlomo has reference to God. So in a sense, we could say that God and Shlomo become one. In other words, because that's the nature of a love relationship, the becoming of one. So Shlomo HaMelech becomes one with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He has, Shir HaShirim is the love relationship. And I think to a certain sense, that was Yehoshua. Since he was the Talmud of Moshe, he didn't leave the tent of Moshe. And he shouldn't have left the tent of Moshe when that was necessary. But that presented a challenge for him. What's going to happen when he's forced to leave the tent of Moshe? And you see, but Yehoshua said to Moshe, Adoni Moshe claimed, when he heard people were saying Nevuah, prophecy about Moshe Meis, Yeshua Machnes Yisrael Aretz. He couldn't deal with that. Because his whole devotion to HaKadosh Baruch Hu was through Moshe. So now there was a challenge. So the Yud cut. The Yud was added to his name, that Yehoshua and God, in a sense, God, Yehoshua, in a sense, has this oneness relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that's the reason why Yehoshua, he had to establish a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu to a certain degree that was independent. Plus, as we show him, everything is through the Torah. But he had to have an independent relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even when Moshe isn't there, he should have this deep personal relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Yud added to his name was indicative of that personal relationship. And Halei, on the other hand, who was not that close to Moshe, although related, but Kalev was not always in the Ohel of Moshe. So he focused to a large degree on the idea of being the continuation from the Avos. But it's one thing, it's true, the Avos had passed away a long time beforehand. But as I've mentioned many times, when the Jewish people were all camped around the Mishkan, when they were like a family, as I mentioned, the Medrash says that the Jewish people were camped around the Mishkan in the same way that they were in carrying the Aron, in carrying the coffin of Yaakov. In that same order, what's the idea? The idea is the last time a family, to a certain sense, comes together is at the funeral of the patriarch or the matriarch. But the Jewish people the future of the Jewish people was not just to be a nation. They had to continue as a family. So they camped around the Mishkan in the same order that they camped, that they stood around the Aron, that they carried the Aron of Yaakov, because that sense of family continued. We are a nation, but we are a family. And when we are a family, the Avos are still alive. And it's interesting, I mentioned the Medrash. The Medrash says that the four sides, the four camps around the Mishkan, had four flags. The one camp had on it the letters in their flag, Aleph Yud Yud. The second had Beis Sadek Ayin. The third had Resh Ches Kuf. And the fourth had Mem Kuf Veis. When you put all those letters together, you have Avram Yitzhak Yaakov. In other words, when a family remains a family, when they stay together after the patriarch is gone, the patriarch is not gone. He is still there. So Kalev ben Yefuneh, while he was there camped around the Mishkan together with the rest of the Jewish people who were camped there as a family, in a sense, Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov were still alive. But now that he had to leave, so he faced a new test. Do Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov remain alive for him? Or because he was only accustomed to see them because he was part of the family? Now that he is removed from the family for a 40-day period, will he be able to still maintain that relationship with Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov? So when Kalev went to the Maaret HaMachpelah, so that was a demonstration. That was his attempt, a successful attempt, of course, to show that he can maintain that relationship with the patriarchs, with the Mesorah, even when he is away from the rest of Klal Yisrael. Now, there is a big lesson from all of this. And the lesson from all of this is that changing situations present challenges. And I mentioned my father would answer the question, why is it, on one hand, we say the Jewish people said Na'aseh v'nishma, and they were in a level higher than Malachim. On the other hand, we say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu raised the mountain over them and said, in the Kabbalah Satorah Mutav, if you accept the Torah, good. If not, shamta heik furaschem, there will be your kfura. And my father said, the Jewish people willingly accepted it for their generation, but future generations, they didn't willingly accept it. I don't know that it means that they said no. But what it meant is, we have to provide the spirit, give the future generations the ability to overcome changing situations. And my father mentioned, I think he said in the name of the Meshech Chachma, in the Kabbalah Satorah Mutav, in Lav, Sham Tahek Farasan, there will be your burial. There will be your end. There will be your destruction. It should say here. But the answer is, right now, your situation, as was proved, was situational. But if our commitment is only situational, and we are not ready to deal with changing situations, and ready to deal doesn't mean that we say that we're going to do it. It means that we have to be educated in how to do it, to take precautions, not to assume that we can make sure the situation doesn't change. Then shun to hate for us. If we're not able to inculcate in our chinuch system the idea that irregardless of the situation, you can remain committed to Torah. Of course, it's ideally that you be in a situation that lends you to that, in a sense, inspires you to say Torah. But we don't control the future. So we should learn a lesson when the Jews move from place to place. How many were lost? And whether we have to move or not is not always in our hands. Sometimes for personal reasons. Sometimes for health reasons. And sometimes because of national and international reasons. That's the nature of Golus. But the nature of Golus demands of us that we give commitment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, commitment to the Torah that's not situational. And in a sense, I think that perhaps at that time, they understood that marriage represents a challenge. Because marriage is already, of course, we say, Al Ken Yazov Ish, Ezov Vesimo, Vedavak Vishto. But nevertheless, it presents a challenge. The commitment that we had, the linkage of the Mesorah that we had, is being challenged when we enter a marriage. And sometimes, on the contrary, the marriage reinforces it. The marriage makes it stronger. But because of the changing times that were taking place, the political winds, that were taking place throughout Europe at that time, leaving your previous environment and entering a new environment offered a different, offered a challenge. And consequently, the perhaps the Gol Yisrael of that time felt that they were not, that the people were not meeting the challenge properly. Now, openly, they probably were, at least at that point. Shortly afterwards, it was different. They were meeting the challenge. But Rabbi Yaakov, the Baal HaTanya, he took great pride that he instituted that mikvos should have warm water. Because there is a machlokas as to whether mikvos should have warm water. And because of that, most of the mikvos at that time did not, up to that time, time of the Baal HaTanya, did not have warm water. The Baal HaTanya instituted, I was told, that to rely on the opinions that you could have warm water in the mikvah, which that was more or less universally accepted. And I assume he said he took great pride in that takana. And I assume the reason is because Taras HaMashpacha was reinforced with that takana. Things that are in private, you never know what happens in the house. And because of that, these were some of the challenges. There were private challenges and public challenges and ideological challenges that were taking place because of the changes of environment that were taking place because people through marriage were entering a different situation, a new situation. And perhaps that was the reason the Gol Yisrael understood what the problem was. And because of that, they instituted a fast, a day of tshuva, a day of evaluating one's deeds at an age that was associated with marriage, because entering the environment of marriage, entering into a new home, represented a challenge for both husband and wife and for the family that they would have.
If anyone has a question, please put it in the chat. We have one question so far. You can hear me, right?
Yeah, I hear you.
Why were the names of the other spies not changed? Maybe they wouldn't have sinned if they had their names changed, and maybe Yeshua would have changed with would have sinned without his name changed.
No. It's not the name change. The name change, first of all, there is an argument as to when the name change actually took place. But the idea of the name change was to emphasize to Yeshua that the relationship that he had with HaKadosh Baruch Hu through Moshe should continue even when he's not associated with Moshe. The changing of the name by itself is nothing. It's the changing of the name was, in a sense, an inspiration, a reminder who he should be and who he could be. It's interesting. The other time we find Yahushua's name is when he goes to war against Amalek. In a sense, he's taking control of the battle. Of course, Moshe is being bespalot HaKadosh Baruch, but he's leading the battle. There is a discussion as to when he got the name change, whether he got the name change earlier or he got the name change later, or it was indicative of a certain promotion of a being like an assistant to Moshe, where to handle things when Moshe, where Moshe wasn't there. Whatever it is, it was indicative of the special position that Yahushua was going to have, and the position that Yahushua was going to have did not always sometimes necessitated that he not be together with Moshe Rabbeinu. The others probably would not have been able to change. I don't know that Moshe was aware that the Meraglim would rebel, even though there are Medrashim that seem to imply that. But I think more likely, and you could somehow understand the Medrashim that way also, the idea was that perhaps Moshe felt that Yahushua should give direction. It was important for Yahushua to have the name change because he'll give direction to the other Meraglim, to the other Meraglim. But the other Meraglim, on the contrary, it seems from the Medrashim, they isolated Yahushua and they weren't interested in his direction.
Okay, there are not any other questions. So thank you, Rebbe. Everyone have a